This session is called, where'd it go? Made Up Missionaries, Fake Faith, and Concocted Conversions, The Alchemy of the Book of Mormon Musical. It actually is on. There's a green light that says it's on.
Oh, that's very.
I guess if I hold it right up here, which just feels weird. All right. My name is Holly Welker. I am the moderator of this session. I was also the person in charge of the bios at Sunstone this summer, and it's interesting to turn to the bios I wrote for myself for each session and see what I decided to tell people. Okay, I have a PhD in English Lit and an MFA in Nonfiction from the University of Iowa. I served in the Taiwan Taichung Mission in the mid-1980s, where I fell through my neighbor's kitchen roof trying to retrieve a letter I dropped off my balcony one P-Day, and then, after some doctor decided I needed antidepressants, had the unlikely experience of trying to explain Western religious despair to a trio of Freudian atheist psychiatrists who spoke to me primarily in Mandarin. Essays about my mission have appeared in a variety of publications, including Alaska Quarterly Review, Dialogue, Sunstone, and the New York Times. Our second speaker will be Mark Shaw, who writes about performance and popular culture. His recent publishing credits include co-editing Performing American Masculinities, The 21st Century Man in Popular Culture, and book chapters about President Obama's masculinities, Harold Pinter's legacy, Stephanie Meyer and Mormonism, performance in 30 Rock, and masculine identity in Neil LaBute's work. Shaw earned his PhD from the University of California at Santa Barbara and teaches theater arts and dramatic literature at Hartwick College in central New York. Shaw's theater work has been presented at Highway Performance Space, Fringe NYC, and UCSB Summer Theater Lab. Our third speaker will be George D. Smith, the author of Nauvoo Polygamy, but we called it Celestial Marriage, which was winner of the John Whitmer Best Book Award for 2009. He also edited Intimate Chronicle, The Journals of William Clayton. Our final speaker will be Clifton Jolly, whose second published piece of criticism was an unfavorable review in BYU Today of Saturday's Warrior, which he later learned elicited more negative mail than anything BYU had published, with the exception of an article on white sugar. Someone with a sense of humor, or else no sense of humor at all, later assigned Lex de Azevedo, who wrote the music for Saturday's Warrior, to be Jolly's home teacher. He is convinced that had Saturday's Warrior been successful as theater, theology, literature, or music, Trey Parker and Matt Stone may have not felt compelled to write their musical revelation of Mormonism. All right. I'm going to grab some water. All right. Aristotle really started it, this debate about happening truth versus emotional truth, or nonfiction versus fiction, as contemporary writers might say, or logos versus mythos, as scholars of religion might say, or history versus poetry, as Aristotle said. Poetry is a more philosophical and higher thing than history, for poetry tends to express the universal, history the particular. To Aristotle, poetry's important feature was not that it's in verse. He acknowledged that. The poet and the historian differ not by writing in verse or in prose. The work of Herodotus might be put into verse, and it would still be a species of history, with meter no less than without it, but that it's imaginative, fictional, not what actually happened, but what could happen, and that, he claims, is what makes it universal and superior. A major virtue of history as literary subject matter, on the other hand, is its credibility. Comparing tragedy to comedy and asking why tragedies so often deal with historic catastrophes, Aristotle explains that tragedians still keep to real names, the reason being that what is possible is credible. What has not happened, we do not at once feel sure to be possible, but what has happened is manifestly possible. Otherwise, it would not have happened. Tim O'Brien explores this debate particularly well in How to Tell a True War Story. In any war story, but especially a true one, it's difficult to separate what happened from what seemed to happen. What seems to happen becomes its own happening and has to be told that way. In many cases, a true war story cannot be believed. If you believe it, be skeptical. Often the crazy stuff is true and the normal stuff isn't, because the normal stuff is necessary to make you believe the truly incredible craziness. These ideas have not gone out of style. You will still hear people argue that fiction tells a higher truth than nonfiction, or that stories made of events that are imagined are somehow inherently superior to stories made of events remembered and interpreted. This division falls apart entirely, however, with something like the LDS view of scripture. Scripture is expected to be singularly credible, singularly particular, as well as singularly universal and singularly true. A loving, benevolent God opposed to violence and bloodshed commanded Abraham to kill his only son, and Abraham set out to do it. It's a singular, particular story that really happened and supposedly teaches truths both particular and universal. We learn the particular truth that loving, benevolent deities absolutely can command to slaughter, absolutely can command men to slaughter their sons. We know this because we know it happened once. We also learn the universal truth that a force that controls your fate often demands from you one of the things you value most. Mind you, this story is not so universal that anyone else should kill their kids if they think God is telling them to do that. They should get psychiatric help. But never forget, it's a story that really truly happened. It's history, not poetry. It's logos, not myth. Except that it wasn't written as history, it was written as myth. As Karen Armstrong notes, myth requires either emotional participation of some kind or some kind of ritual mimesis to make any sense at all, while logos tries to establish the truth by means of careful inquiry in a way that appeals only to the critical intelligence. The story of Abraham and Isaac makes sense as a story of the emotional pain of sacrifice and loss, but not as an illustration of God's nature, which, despite all our theologizing and preaching, we cannot comprehend. Here's how Mormons typically differentiate between tragedy, comedy, and other types of Mormon lit. If a character leaves Mormonism, even, especially, if she, he lives what she, he considers happily ever after, it's tragedy. As for comedy, well, what can you expect from a people who are counseled to cease from all your light speeches, from all laughter, from all your lustful desires, from all your pride and light-mindedness, and from all your wicked doings, as we read in D&C 88:121. Laughter and lust are wicked doings. D&C 59 says that much laughter is sin. So it's no surprise that if something pokes fun at Mormons in a way that makes them uncomfortable, it's neither tragedy nor comedy so much as it's blasphemy and sacrilege. What matters most in the plays, movies, novels, and so forth that Mormons create for Mormons is that the depictions of Mormons be flattering and the point faith-affirming. In other words, Mormon art must be correlated. Which is easy to do given how literal rather than light-minded Mormons are. Mormons are perhaps the most literal-minded people on earth, the most rigorous iconoclasts. By and large, we have no iconography in our chapels to focus our attention on why we're there. No crosses, no sunburst or rays of light, piercing a great darkness, few depictions of Christ in Gethsemane. We do not understand symbols and we avoid them, typically putting on our headstones literal representations of the literal temples where a couple was married. It's true that such images are representational, but something that is representational is not necessarily a symbol. The work of John McNaughton illustrates this quite well. Visit his website and read his commentary of his work. He insists that everything in it is symbolic. Instead, nothing is symbolic. A painting of the Constitution is meant to be the Constitution, not a symbol of something else. Obama stepping on the Constitution without caring what he treads on is meant to show viewers that Obama steps on the Constitution without caring what he treads on. Like many Mormons, McNaughton confuses what is consequential with what is symbolic. What does this have to do with the Book of Mormon musical? Whether Trey Parker, Matt Stone, and Robert Lopez set out to examine and illustrate Aristotelian ideas of universality and show the failings of Mormon art, they do a good job of both. The play valorizes religious myths and spiritual metaphors as more valuable and useful than historically rooted religious dogma and doctrine because myths and metaphors are more flexible. How would our discussions of polygamy change if we recognized it as a metaphor rather than a requirement for righteousness and exaltation? Joseph Smith worked pretty hard to convince people that the Book of Mormon is a work of history written on real gold plates that he hefted and held. that the Father God and Son God he saw were literal men with literal bodies and literal genitals. That the literal mother in heaven he asks us to believe in was probably back home minding her literal other kids when the Father and Son appeared to him. How would we understand the limitations of his experience and create a greater range of possibilities for our own experiences of the divine if we understood his experience as a vision of transcendent glory rooted in and communicable only through the metaphors and symbols readily available to him, rather than a literal encounter with beings best described and understood in the terms we use to describe and understand ourselves? Mormons become very focused on the historical, particular side of this debate. Mormons, both faithful and lapsed, have parsed the Book of Mormon musical's fidelity or lack thereof to Mormon theology and culture in a way only Mormons can. I've engaged in such conversations myself and am not going to repeat them here. If you're really curious, you can talk to me afterwards and I can refer you to some websites. What I'd rather consider is what Mormons look like to others. What an authentic Mormon story seems like to those who, without embracing the myths we tell about ourselves, watch us live our lives and try to find apt metaphors with which to describe what we look like to them. Richard Bushman told CNN that although he hadn't seen the show and had only heard part of the soundtrack, he understood that Mormons experience the show like looking at themselves in a funhouse mirror. The reflection is hilarious, but not really you. The nose is yours, but swollen out of proportion. But I'm here to say otherwise. I think that Mormons are so immersed in their own perspective that any depiction they make of themselves looks more like a cubist portrait than a mirror image of who Mormons really are. We're like teenagers standing an inch from the mirror, anxious about any blemish or flaw that might make us unattractive. Only those who can take a step or two away from us can see the whole picture. So it's not surprising that the South Park guys arrive at all sorts of great insights about Mormons and that their portraits of Mormons and Mormonism are faithful and accurate as opposed to faith-promoting and proper. We want to tell a particular story about what it feels like for us to be us, while the minds behind the musical want to tell a universal story of what community, faith, and the loss of both feel like via Mormons. So here are some things I've learned from the musical about what we have conveyed to others about who we are. 1. Mormons entrust the most important message they have to offer the rest of the world primarily to ill-prepared and immature teenagers whose lack of maturity and experience frequently impairs their ability to relate to those they hope to teach. 2. Mormon women are irrelevant to an authentic Mormon story. There is a grand total of one Mormon woman played by a woman with a speaking role, the African-American woman who dresses up as in a Lion King costume as part of the missionary send-off to Uganda at the Salt Lake Airport. The missionaries' mothers are played by white men in drag. There are investigators who, after they are baptized, end up in white shirts and ties as missionaries for the latest Mormon splinter group. But the thoughts, words, actions of women born and raised in the church and women buried and raising children in the church do not need to be included in order to tell a story that is authentically Mormon. This is our fault. This is what we look like to the world. In our foundational story, the story of Joseph in the sacred grove, when God wants to reveal his truth to his children, he doesn't bring their mother with him, his partner in their conception, birth, and upbringing. No, he brings their big brother, and he talks to his son. The story of Mormonism is the story of daddy talking to and through his sons. Mothers and daughters are secondary. This situation helps facilitate a third aspect of an authentic Mormon story. Mormons are dishonest about their relationship to power. "You and me, but mostly me," expresses this quite well. Elder Price sings, "You and me, but mostly me, are going to change the world forever, because I can do most anything," at which point his companion, Elder Cunningham, chimes in, "and I can stand next to you and watch." And one of the greatest insights I had about this whole play was that that is essentially Mormon patriarchy and Mormon marriage. God the Father is the hero. Heavenly Mother, if she exists at all, is a sidekick. And if you have not heard that song, find it on YouTube, listen to it, and imagine it sung between a newlywed Mormon couple. It absolutely explains Mormon gender roles. Relationships such as marriage that are ostensibly about almost equal partnership are in reality relationships in which one person intentionally has more authority and agency, and so is the hero or the dinner, while the lesser partner is the sidekick or the side dish on the slightly smaller plate. 4. Mormons dislike unpleasant truths and are adept at ignoring them, as explored in the song Turn It Off. This business of Mormon women being irrelevant to Mormon stories is something most Mormons will simply discount. It doesn't matter that, as President Hinckley pointed out, we have absolutely no revealed knowledge about Heavenly Mother except that she exists. She's still somehow equal to Heavenly Father. Mormons are happy moral people, despite the fact that Utah has the highest rates in the nation of antidepressant use and online porn consumption. Don't tell them otherwise. Mormons force themselves to believe, despite the difficulty of doing so. A high point of the show, one so pivotal to the action that it was performed at the Tonys, is when Elder Price tries to banish his doubts by bearing his testimony to himself. If you haven't already seen it, watch I Believe on YouTube. A testimony is less a statement of what the average Mormon does actually believe than what they know they should believe. I hope you noticed the title of yesterday's devotional, How to Believe When You Don't Really Think You Can. I don't know how people can take such beliefs seriously. The only period of my life where I had to remind myself each day of what I believed was during my mission. I don't have to force myself to believe that gravity is the force that keeps me on this planet. I don't have to force myself to believe that spinach is good for me, or that children under the age of 10 shouldn't have to work for a living, or that meat inspection and regulations are a good thing, or that support for the arts is essential to a civilized society because art nourishes the human soul. If a belief takes work, it's not a belief. 6. Mormons have a disproportionate sense of sin. In Spooky Mormon Hell Dream, Elder Price tells Hitler, Genghis Khan, Jeffrey Dahmer, and Johnny Cochran that his sin is more egregious than theirs because he left his companion. It's played for laughs, but it's not an outlandish stretch for people who are told that an engaged couple madly in love who have sex before an official ceremony have defiled themselves and committed a sin barely removed from willfully and cruelly ending a human life, or that coffee consumption is a reliable index of a human being's moral worth. That's why Spooky Mormon Hell Dream features dancing demonic Starbucks cups. And although the musical doesn't make this point, I want to draw a corollary. Because Mormons judge themselves so harshly, they are very judgmental of others. 7. Mormons' greatest virtue is niceness. I personally think that niceness, or a sort of social pleasantness, is an inferior virtue. One can be nice, not make waves, smile when one is upset, and still be passive-aggressive and angry underneath. Passive aggression becomes much more difficult, however, if one is trying to cultivate genuine kindness and empathy. Mormons struggle with this because they find charity even towards themselves difficult. As I mentioned in the last point, they don't want to feel their own pain. Doubt, same-sex attraction, any temptation at all can be vanquished through an act of will. 8. But even more than niceness, Mormons have a commitment to homogeneity or correlation. Hence the rejection of the new converts who take Elder Cunningham's imaginative reworkings of Mormon belief and run with them. Hence the acute anxiety of real Mormons over whether the show is doctrinally accurate. 9. This is my favorite. You can sum up the entire church ethos in 6 words. Listen to the fat white guy. 10. Because rather than despite of all these reasons, Mormons are fascinating, a paradoxical blend of deliberately cultivated authenticity and arrogant humility. People most of the world don't care to join forever, but still rather enjoy hanging out with briefly. In the process of painting this portrait, Parker Stone and Lopez have a mission president in a dung-colored suit. And at one point he exclaims, "Praise Christ," something that would never happen in real Mormon life. They have a backdrop for Utah with ugly weird steps stuck on the front of the Salt Lake Temple. They make other errors in that, for instance, they talk about the hell the way it's discussed in the Book of Mormon and by Brigham Young and by millions of Latter-day Saints instead of discussing outer darkness and the celestial kingdom and the more official doctrines we have. In short, they put us in clothes that aren't our own. But they see our features and our proportions clearly. And despite our flaws, or perhaps because of them, they like us. They like watching us and listening to us, even when we don't make sense. It has been interesting to watch the resentment the show has aroused among Mormons. It's slammed for its realism, talking about missions as this obligatory enterprise that often has little to do with the father and son and utterly ignores the mother of which we know so little, as well as for underscoring how literally Mormons take the command to be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth, or listing some of Mormon's strangest beliefs and teachings. The show has also been slammed for its metaphors. Baptism for sex, for instance, even though many an elder has noticed how the role of missionary makes him more attractive to cute girls, or for putting mission presidents not in the dark blue suits Mormon leaders favor, but in hideous shit-covered suits that emphasize an ugly allegiance to authority, alienation from the people over whom they have authority, and ultimate irrelevance to a happy spiritual life. To borrow from Oscar Wilde, the Mormon dislike of realism is the rage of Caliban seeing his own face in the glass. The Mormon dislike of metaphor is the rage of Caliban not seeing his own face in the glass. This is why I think it will be a very long time before we finally manage to have our own Shakespeare's and Milton's, as the oft-repeated prophecy proclaims. That and the fact that we can't see a significant difference between history and poetry, fiction or nonfiction, or mythos and logos when it comes to telling our own stories. And when we finally do manage to produce and inspire our own Miltons and Shakespeares, to say nothing of our own Jane Austens, Emily Dickinsons, and a Maxine Hong Kingston or two, it will be because the Parkers and Stones of the world have taught us how to see ourselves as we really are. Until then, we refuse to believe that people can love us for who we really are instead of who we think we should be, or that we can embrace both our reflections in the funhouse mirror and our reflection in a mirror in a public restroom under Hart's fluorescent lights. Okay, Mark.
When South Park creators Trey Parker and Matt Stone visited The Daily Show to publicize their new Broadway musical, The Book of Mormon, host Jon Stewart, who had just attended a preview performance, could not hold back his praise. He gushed, "You've always set a bar here at Comedy Central that we've all aimed at. This Book of Mormon is so good, it makes me effing angry. I have to tell you, I can't tell you how impressed I was. It's like your doctoral thesis. You've somehow managed to satirize religion while simultaneously almost celebrating it in this sweet yet really hard-edged, I don't know what to say, honestly." I've never seen Jon Stewart speechless and seemingly contradictory in this way. Satirize religion and celebrate it, sweet and hard-edged. Stewart admits not being able to find the words to describe the Book of Mormon's complexities, so perhaps I might suggest the phrase of another John, Keats, to describe the work. Keats says that Shakespeare has a negative capability, meaning, quote, "a man who is capable of being in uncertainties, mysteries, doubts, without any irritable reaching after fact and reason." Indeed, Jon Stewart inadvertently suggested the idea of negative capability later in the Daily Show interview with Parker and Stone. Quote, "It didn't seem like you guys were expressing a certainty about things. It felt like an expression of a confusion about religion." Matt Stone agreed that they were satisfied to exist in a state of uncertainty towards their subject matter and embrace the mystery. Trey Parker responded a bit more simply and comically with just, "We are extremely confused." Stone insists that embracing the mystery in the musical means celebrating a contradiction. Quote, "a celebration of Mormonism from guys who aren't Mormons." Perhaps one of the reasons the pair returned to Mormonism as subject matter yet again is because they imagine a potential negative capability within Mormonism itself. Quote, "it's a religion that is still young," says Stone, "still growing and changing. And in changing, perhaps it might still become something better in the future. After all, that's how the musical ends, with the entire cast declaring themselves Latter-day Saints and rousingly belting, "Tomorrow is a latter day," in which latter day seems synonymous with better day. In part, the musical functions then as Stone Parker and the third creator, Robert Lopez's vision of the positive capabilities within the LDS faith and within religion in general. This celebration hits us alongside the more hard-edged content, and for that reason, I would not suggest that every LDS member run out and watch the musical on Broadway, even buy the soundtrack. But as a proselytizing work, the Book of Mormon will, and as a proselytizing tool, the Book of Mormon will not be replacing its upstate cousin, the Hill Cumorah pageant, anytime soon. But there is no reason to think the musical will do the church harm. Suggesting that this musical is one-sided or certain in its approach is where problems arise. Some in the media, such as John Mark Reynolds in the Washington Post, say that it is bigoted towards Mormons. For the first time in my scholastic life, Facebook became a place to find sources about these matters, as at least four LDS friends who I admire updated their statuses with declarations boycotting the musical, linking to Reynolds' article in the Post, or also in the Post to Michael Otterson's informative, touching, but unnecessary list of all the good the LDS Church does in Africa. Comparing the Book of Mormon musical to the broad racism of Amos and Andy, Reynolds says the jokes are cruel and tasteless, and they end up mocking the moral, because Mormonism is a minority religion loathed in the theater community. However, halfway through his rant, Reynolds admits his own shaky foundation. Quote, "I cannot know for sure without seeing the entire play." As a theater maker myself, I know the power of the live moment, the energy in the room when the actors and audience share the same space. None of the negative reviews I have read experienced the live performance. The audience I was with sat in the theater for 2 hours, focused and invested in a version of the LDS mission experience. Like all protagonists worth watching, the two main missionaries, Elders Cunningham and Price, have their flaws, but they ultimately try to do what is right. And in the live moment, the lead actors also have a charisma, what theater scholar Joseph Roach calls it, which the theater audience feels, making their desire to understand the missionaries' experiences even more profound. One other Facebook friend, Lane Anderson, who lives in Manhattan and teaches writing there, argues in a Salt Lake Tribune article that if you can stand the musical's content, then you should try to see it. Anderson uses Richard Bushman's rhetorical question, quote, "Wouldn't it be wonderful if through this funny and outrageous show, we, Mormons and non-Mormons, got to know one another better?" Anderson continues, "It can be hard to join a dialogue when you don't know what others are saying." LDS writers who have attended the musical, including Glenn Nelson of the Mormon Artists Group Online, realize the musical does not mock the moral. It celebrates those who follow big dreams and sincerely seek to do good in the world. Like many satires from the Greeks to Molière to Colbert, the targets worth mocking include hypocrisy, repression, and naivete. In the song "I Believe," performed at this year's Tony's, that Holly mentioned, the lyrics make light of some of the stranger LDS beliefs. But even as the song does that, and here we have a negative capability at work, it sincerely celebrates the leap of faith in religion through the lyrics and through Andrew Rennell's energized performance. Furthermore, the creator's research into the mission experience and thoughtful examinations of questions of faith amidst all the satire and scatological content belies any claim of mocking the moral. In attending the performance at the Eugene O'Neill Theater, it allows one to feel the hope and the love the diverse audience invests in the LDS missionary characters. But like many comedies, the Book of Mormon capitalizes on tensions between the pure and the grotesque, what reviewer David Cote calls the scatotheological, and also in the tension between the sacred and the profane. Never before have so many F words and Mormons intermingled in a script side by side. The contradictory tensions continue until the work's finale, when we see that the act of telling stories, even when the stories are false, can inspire African villagers to change for the better. It ends up being a feel-good American musical exploring the all-American religion, but set in a squalid Ugandan village. Musicologist Raymond Knapp points out that the musical form has often explored that this has explored American identity. From the mythologies of Oklahoma to guys and dolls to the counter mythologies of hair and assassins to dealing with America's others in West Side Story, Porgy and Bess, Fiddler on the Roof, and even The King and I, musicals explore the difference between us to sort out what America is now. On the Broadway stage, Parker, Stone, and Lopez have figured out a way to commodify, both capitalistically and artistically, the differences in the uniquely American Mormon religion. In a sense, one way to the American mainstream flows across the Broadway stage. One can understand the apprehension felt by any subculture when an outsider seeks to tell its story. In this symposium focused on the materiality of Mormon artifacts, nothing is more of a material reality in Mormon culture than the Book of Mormon. All LDS members have powerful memories of holding the book in their hands, and its significance goes beyond the material to the emotional and spiritual. So it is an odd phenomenon to see the Book of Mormon with a parental advisory, explicit language when you buy your Broadway ticket or the soundtrack CD. The creators were bold enough to name their work the Book of Mormon, not Two Elders, One Mission, or a non-Mormon celebration of Mormonism, or even Uganda! Exclamation point. So to many, this material thing is now another material thing altogether. It is rewritten, another testament. On 49th Street in Manhattan, it has a stage and curtains and actors, and it's making millions, selling out 8 times a week to 102% capacity. Even in the immateriality of the internet, when you Google the Book of Mormon now, all the surrounding advertising links for the are for the musical. And 3 of the top 5 website links are too. The LDS Church's official statement connects the pair of material realities, but contrasts their eternal significance. Quote, "The production may attempt to entertain audiences for an evening, but the Book of Mormon as a volume of scripture," and needing to add that kind of as a volume of scripture, "will change people's lives forever by bringing them closer to Christ." So to return to negative capability, how does the musical's content exist in uncertainty? Some of the doctrinal questions that are left open include tensions in faith, prayer, and continuing revelation. In the song All American Prophet, the young American missionaries teach their Ugandan investigator the story of Joseph Smith's life, including the first vision, translation of the Book of Mormon, and his eventual death. Throughout the song, there is repeated comic insinuation that if only Joseph Smith had shown people the golden plates instead of translating them onto paper, then we would all now know he was a prophet. The apparent skewering of Joseph Smith's prophet status parallels the South Park episode All About Mormons, in which an unseen chorus underscores and undercuts many of the details of Joseph Smith's history with dum, 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 dum. But in the stage musical version, what seems inevitable is not so. As he dies, the mood of the music turns unmistakably somber, and Joseph Smith sings, "Oh God, why are you letting me die without having me show people the plates? They'll have no proof I was telling the truth or not. They'll have to believe it just 'cause." Oh, I guess that's kind of what you were going for. And then the prophet dies as a woodwind instrument laments in the background. In performance, that moment is sincere and touching, and the most affecting part of it is that Joseph Smith has an epiphany that God knows what he's doing. It is clearly also an exploration of a central component of faith, that without material proof that the titular book came from God, the followers have to seek spiritual answers for themselves. Elsewhere in the musical, in the song I Believe, this exploration continues when Elder Price sings the way in which faith can grow more and more into certainty. Quote, The scriptures say that if you ask in faith, if you ask God himself, you'll know, but you must ask him without any doubts and let your spirit grow. All of these ideas come straight from the actual first missionary first discussion and from the Book of Mormon, Moroni 10:4-5. With a reference that comes almost verbatim from the original Book of Mormon, one can see why Trey Parker gave a shout out to his co-writer, Joseph Smith, when they won one of their 9 Tony Awards in June. The script embraces the mysteries of faith in a serious manner. It is up to you to discover the truth for yourself. The musical explores spiritual questions about prayer. In the final song, Tomorrow is a Latter Day, we learn that one of the reasons Mormons are happy is because they pray. And in doing so, they can feel that tomorrow will be a better day. The complete cast has converted to Mormonism and gives the audience the following invitation. So if you're sad, put your hands together and pray that tomorrow's going to be a latter day. And then it probably will be a latter day. So to make ourselves happier, we need to pray. But there are uncertainties within prayer. Is it God who makes us happier as a blessing? Or is it the very act of praying, the motion of our hands together and perhaps our knees on the ground that humbles us to self-awareness and eventual happiness? The issue hinges on the word probably. If you pray that tomorrow will be better, then it probably will be. Does it matter if God is there or not, or if God even hears our prayers? Again, in this instance, the question is open and uncertain. The Book of Mormon musical also wonders what might be considered a good lie. Elder Cunningham's fictional stories help save lives in Uganda. He likens the scriptures to the lives of the Ugandan people, but a bit too specifically. Yet it works. Lives are happier. Tomorrow is a latter day for those converts. And dramaturgically, the moment that Elder Cunningham makes up his own doctrines is the moment he passes from boy to prophet and man. This type of uncertainty where untrue stories make our lives happy, truly happy, is the negative capability that the Book of Mormon musical embraces. Thank you.
Just starting off, can I ask how many of here have seen the play, The Book of Mormon? Do you mind if I count? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7.
How did you get tickets? Was there on the second night?
Seven out of 40. That's kind of interesting. I decided to go before hearing any reviews, any negative comments, almost anything about what the play concerned. This was in winter of this last year, and it was just a chance that it might become an interesting play, certainly unique. I didn't know it was going to be good, but it happened to turn out to be good. So deciding to go before reviews, before reactions, and before opening was, I think, a good decision, as it turns out. Hopefully it will come here to the Capitol Theater in Salt Lake, and we'll all just walk down and find cheap seats and available seats. That would be really great. One night in May, we went in a group of, I guess there were 12 of us. We were celebrating the 30th anniversary of Signature Books, so we decided to do that as a celebration. We walked into the theater, the lights went out, the curtain came up, and right away, the prologue informed us what the play was about. Long ago, a Nephite leader in ancient New York, a appears in voice, "I am Mormon. My people sailed here from Israel. These golden plates tell how we met Jesus Christ." Another voice follows, "I am Jesus. Soon, Mormon, you will be gone. Care for the plates." Then a third voice, "I am Moroni, Mormon's son." And he buries the plates in a hill, quote, "giving birth to the fastest growing religion today." So it's serious and in a way naively boastful. A kind of an interesting start, and everybody is riveted to what's on the stage. Then, after these prologue comments by voices, we have action. "Ding dong, my name is Elder Price. I would like to share with you this most amazing book." And what could it possibly be? Then another doorbell rings. We see these pictures of doorbells, great pictures of doorbells. And ding dong, my name is Elder Grant. And then Elder Green, Elder Young, Elder Brown. And finally, ding dong, my name is Elder Cunningham. And he speaks, "Would you like to change religions? I have a free book written by Jesus." Well, you know, whatever you are in the audience, you're hooked. What is he going to say next? And then off stage, we get commentary of these elders, and somebody says, "No, you're making things up again. Just stick to the script, the missionary script." Then the elders are sent off to missions. One to France. We hear that Satan has a hold on France. So every place has a characterization. And then, as you pointed out two or three times, the phrase comes early and is repeated all through the play, "See you tomorrow." Tomorrow is always a latter day. Well, you're on a roll at that point. And Elders Price and Cunningham are paired and sent to Uganda. What? Uganda? They don't even have doorbells there. That's so sweet. Since Ugandans' needs differ from those of America, the missionaries continue to make things up. Or is it metaphor, another way of expressing truth? Well, this tension is in there, and that says something about religion, this religion, and others. If you say things that are good for people, is it a way of expressing something meaningful? And maybe it's not quite accurate, but a metaphor is something that that achieves a result. Part of this, to deal with AIDS, which is a real problem in Uganda, the image of a frog is called up. Derives from Joseph Smith meeting a large toad in the woods as he's walking through to protect the plates. After meeting this frog, it said in the play, Smith had no AIDS, no more. And then the chorus comes up. You're making this up again, Elder. You're making things up. So we know they're making things up, and it continues, and it's part of the game. And you don't mind if they make things up. It's kind of in good spirit, as it turns out. Soon the villagers, regarding this frog image, began wearing dead frog cod pieces, which is meant to cure their AIDS, which is an epidemic almost all through the town. And truths are emphasized by a chorus, which at this point comes in and says, a Mormon just believes. So you have statements, you have things that are made up, you have purpose, and then don't challenge, just believe. And it's something that Mormons perhaps hear. And this continues. God lives on a planet called Kolob. Then a chorus. I believe. Jesus has his own planet as well. I believe. And I believe that the Garden of Eden was in Jackson County, Missouri. A Mormon just believes. And then the chorus. I believe. I believe. Well, they caught the Ugandans' attention with the phrase, "And in 1978, God changed his mind about black people." And the chorus comes out again, "You'll be a Mormon who just believes." And as it turns out, the women want to marry the missionaries. Now, that never happens, right, anywhere else? Well, it certainly happens in Uganda. And for these women, things are very direct. And as it turns out, sex is their currency. And they're quite familiar. And so they yield to the missionary's words. And the girl, Nabalungi, says, "After the Mormons came, I've never seen people here so happy." And she sings, "He will baptize me." I don't know the song exactly, but I think it's like this. "He will hold me in his arms." And then the elder responds to this, "I'll baptize her with everything I've got, and then I'll make her beg for more." Well, it's a new dimension for missionaries. as they left the script, the MTC script, then the missionaries become Africa. And there's a phrase, "I am Africa, we are Africa." And in doing this, they leave the missionary script and they think, how can we help the people? And as this develops, I won't get specific, and I'll just let you know there's a surprise ending, and it'll be worth the wait. Well, we've heard some of the reactions in the New York Times. Benjamin Brantley called it a singing, dancing history of the founding of the Mormon Church. Well, in a literal sense, that's what it is, but the literary dimensions go way beyond. And it does include, I think you might have mentioned this, the director, choreographer, Casey Nicolau, who did A Drowsy Chaperone. Did you happen to see that? That was a couple of years before, and a great musical on Broadway. And I think some of the strength of the music and the motion in this theater was probably due to this Casey Nicolau. Previews were February 24th, opening night March 24th at the Eugene O'Neill Theater, and they were publicizing the address all over the newspapers, 230 West 49th Street, if you happen to get back there, 212-239-6200. There were other reviews that were interesting. One was James Fenton in the New York Review of Books on July 24th of this year. The title was "The Saints Take Broadway." And he frames the musical with, quote, "the faith's wobbly story of golden tablets dug up and then lost to view." Now, at this point, I would have to say that none of the reviewers that I had read seemed to capture the historical reference of the entire continent of Native Americans seen as disconnected from the Genesis creation narrative of the old world. And this certainly seems to be part of Joseph Smith's interest, is uniting the old world with the new, and therefore supporting the Bible, which was under very serious criticism from deists and skeptics and others. And by identifying Indian tribes as descendant Hebrew tribes, Joseph Smith made the Bible seem universal again, at least to those of Judeo-Christian mindset. The various reactions included public affairs director Otterson, who spoke positively of the play, but then sort of negatively. He said, "But I don't need to see it." So then there's this sense of perhaps avoiding the play. And like coffee, the play of not seeing the play becomes an outward symbol of Mormon convictions. And he's not the only Mormon who's said this. We've seen this on blogs, and I've heard individuals say this. Dick Bushman apparently had not seen the play when he last wrote about it. But he says, as you pointed out, such a funny and outrageous show might be a means for us to get to know one another. So he's saying, let's not reject it, although by example, I don't know that he's gone to see it yet. So the church reaction, I would have to say, is very positive and very smart. They've developed a program of billboards. We are Mormons. I am a Mormon. And presenting a campaign of stories of ordinary people all over Broadway. You walk onto Times Square and look up and hear Mormons. And then I guess there's something on the computer where you can Google and find all these ordinary Mormons, good people, and you sort of like them. And so I think taking the leverage from this publicity in a positive way, rather than trying to argue point by point and saying we're offended, I don't think the church has done that. I think the church has played a very positive reaction, and I would say they should be congratulated for, you know, the natural instinct might be to defend, and I think that would have been the wrong reaction. Well, I guess at this point, I would have to say my response is that in the New York Times, which said, see the play and musicals, this is good, worthy of the Tony Award, one of the best musicals, equally as good as Drowsy Chaperone, maybe the Book of Mormon will come to the Capitol Theater, and maybe we will have a Sunstone showing. So keep tuned.
Microphone.
Yeah.
They broke it. Can you hear me?
No. You have
Can you hear me?
Yes.
How will I hold the microphone and run my computer at the same time? I seldom find myself to be the most conservative panelist. So conservative, as it turns out, that I disagree with some of what every other panelist has said. What precisely, I wonder, is so bad about being a sidekick to God? And as for gravity, since Einstein and quantum physics, we really know less about that than we do about God's wife. As for F-words and Mormons being found together, I myself predate this musical's discovery of that tradition. Then, we're told to see the Book of Mormon musical before we read the reviews. That's simply anti-Mormon. I can't remember the last time in general conference I was told to figure anything out for myself. And after telling us not to listen to the reviews, you went right ahead and reviewed it. Well, as one who has only today discovered himself to be a conservative, you will not be surprised to learn that I've also and always found that figuring out how to be a Mormon is just plain hard work. And I'm still working at it. And the Book of Mormon musical has helped. Peter Schaefer's play, Royal Hunt of the Sun, dramatizes the conquest and destruction of the Inca nation by Francisco Pizarro. In one of several conversations between Pizarro and the god king Atahualpa, Pizarro presumes to belittle the Inca worship of the sun and the human sacrifice that is its sacrament. To which Atahualpa replies, I've seen what you do with your God. You break him into little pieces and you eat him. I first saw the play in a fine production at BYU where I was teaching students to write their personal histories. And the denunciation of the Catholic sacrament of transubstantiations got not only laughter but applause from the audience of Mormon students and professors. And I thought at the time, you ninnies, Schaefer isn't putting up a lens to just Catholics, he's magnifying us too. But not so well, nor so directly, as have Trey Parker and Matt Stone in the Book of Mormon musical, which is the dramatization not of how our Book of Mormon got written, but how an entirely other Book of Mormon got written. Briefly, a Mormon elder deserted by his companion, who, like most Mormon missionaries, has not actually read the Book of Mormon, discovers that even what he knows about a church founded in America on a book that talks about Israelites and Jews and Jesus coming to America has little historical or cultural relevance for tribal Ugandans. So he does what any good missionary does. He improvises. Since none of the tribe to which he has been sent can read, he begins to rewrite the book to include stuff that is more relevant to their needs, such as why pedophilia is wrong. Now, I don't know how most Mormons feel about the musical, but I do know how my Mormon son feels about it. And I suspect that his opinion pretty well reflects the opinion of most of the saints, at least in his ward in Kaysville. He doesn't like it one bit. Sure, it's funny, but it makes light of God and prophets and holy books. Now, to be fair, it is a musical comedy. And that's pretty much what musical comedy is supposed to do, make light of stuff. And to be further fair, the musical accomplishes its task by being mostly pretty accurate about what we Mormons believe. In fact, one of my daughters, who no longer considers herself a Mormon, unless you're a Baptist who wants to say Mormons aren't Christians, in which case she's ready to fight, she points out to me that most of the people she has talked to about the musical don't think we actually believe a lot of what the play says we believe, and we actually do. They can't tell the difference between irony and our faith. Nowhere is this better evidence than in the song that was featured at the Tony Awards, already referenced, I Believe. In it, the elder, who will soon become a prophet to the tribe by writing a Book of Mormon in which they actually can benefit by believing, simply lists a number of things in which he believes. And it was listening to this song and hearing for the first time so many of our beliefs laid end to end without comment or explanation that I first understood what a peculiar people we really are. I quote, I believe that the Lord God created the universe. I believe that he sent his only son to die for my sins. And I believe that ancient Jews built boats and sailed to America. I am a Mormon, and Mormons just believe. You cannot believe part way, you have to believe it all. The problem is doubting the Lord's will instead of standing tall. I can't allow myself to have any doubt. It's time to set my worries free. Time to show the world what Elder Price is about and share the power inside of me. I believe that God has a plan for all of us. I believe that plan involves me getting my own planet. And I believe that the current president of the church, Thomas Monson, speaks directly to God. I am a Mormon, and dang it, a Mormon just believes. I know that I must go and do the things my God commands. I realize now why he sent me here. You ask the Lord in faith, he will always answer you. Just believe in him and have no fear. I believe that Satan has a hold of you. I believe that the Lord God has sent me here, and I believe that in 1978, God changed his mind about black people. You can be a Mormon who just believes. And now I can feel the excitement. This is the moment I was born to do. I feel so incredible to be sharing my faith with you. The scriptures say that if you ask anything, if you ask God himself, he'll know. But you must ask him without any doubt and let your spirit grow. I believe that God lives on a planet called Kolob. I believe that Jesus has his own planet as well. And I believe that the Garden of Eden was in Jackson County, Missouri. If you believe, the Lord will reveal it. Well, my son didn't disagree with the facts, and he wasn't offended that some of them were told ironically. What offended him is that the song alleges that Mormons just believe. That's not fair, he protests. I have evidences, and I've worked hard to get them. This makes light of how hard Mormons work to get and to keep testimonies. Fair enough. But to be further fair, the musical is also profane. So profane that the guest server here at Weber State College that is supposed to connect one to the internet blocks access to parts of the musical's website. And I don't know, but for me, it's good to know there are still some things you can't do in Utah. Even at a university. F word. And my 16-year-old granddaughter, who also does not consider herself a Mormon, also doesn't like much of the language used in the play. But come on. What did we expect from the creators of South Park, in which 7-year-old kids swear like truck drivers? And if you have ever milked a cow, you've heard worse. The Book of Mormon musical is an allegory for the writing of the Book of Mormon, of a young boy who is not much schooled in the ways of the world in which he finds himself and unable to be certain of the solutions he already has and of the revelation of a new religion. A religion founded upon a book that had peculiar affinity and importance to the people he would give it to, explaining the relics they found all about them and making more personal and immediate God and his word to them. It's a musical about that Book of Mormon, not ours, which does many of those same things for us. Mormons may not like it, but as I said, it's not entirely about us. And if we think we aren't portrayed in a favorable light, we're simply wrong. Book of Mormon, the musical, is, I think, the best thing to happen to Mormonism since my grandmother stopped slapping my mouth for saying I was a Mormon, a derogatory name given us by persecutors of the church in the 19th century and ultimately canonized by the church following the building and consecration of the Los Angeles Temple, so as to let Gentiles know they weren't excluded from all our churches, only the more important ones. Billboards went up all over LA proclaiming, "You're always welcome in a Mormon church." And Grandma clucked, said "Shaw," and stopped slapping my mouth. The musical is as true to us as the website is to our religion. Once you're off campus and can get a connection that does not have a pornography blocker, visit the website. It has a contest in which you can go on a Mormon mission, and it's a considerably more amusing mission than the one I served. I didn't like Saturday's Warrior, as was mentioned, because it pretended to be doctrinal and wasn't. And also because it made fun of missionaries by portraying them as idiots. One of those hateful letters I got was from a mission president's wife who told me that I was a bad person because all of the missionaries in her mission were just like the missionaries on Saturday's Warrior. I made a point of responding to all 238 letters. And to her, I said, "Sister, perhaps we can agree to disagree. And I'm sure that if I had been a missionary in your mission, I would have snuck in while you slept and strangled you." Because I took it very seriously. I like the Book of Mormon musical because it pretends not to be doctrinal, while it is, and by taking missionaries very, very seriously, it's lots and lots of fun. And it's maybe even art. Some critics are saying it is not only the best musical of this year, it's the best musical that has ever been written. Well, finally, I suspect that some of you are wondering, certainly a member of the panelist will ask, with tickets so hard to get and us so far removed, have I actually seen the play? Well, if you think I'm going to risk the brethren finding out that I financially contributed to a dramatization that makes light of God, his prophets, and our translated correctly book, you're out of your mind.
Well, I want to thank my panelists. I especially want to thank Clifton. I knew that at some point some guy would say, "What's so wrong about being a sidekick, little lady?" I didn't realize it would take less than a freaking hour. I will tell everyone. It's recorded. I'll make sure everyone finds out. Good God.
I'm the only Mormon man who has ever said to Margaret Toscano, "Don't listen to her, she's only a woman."
I bet you're not. That's the point. Anyway, we have slightly more than 20 minutes for questions. If you want to ask a question, since this is being recorded, either say it very loudly, at which point someone will repeat it, or you are welcome to come up and hold the mic, or this being a Mormon forum, we also have to allow people to bear their testimonies. If you want to bear your testimony of the truthfulness or the awfulness of the Book of Mormon musical, feel free. I'm perfectly... does anybody want to be a deacon and actually pass the mic around?
Wait.
One of the things that I thought was wonderful about the musical is that they have used images to tell the story of the church that come from the Hilcomara pageant. So you have Christ, the image of it, you have Christ lighted from within, who comes out, and that Joseph Smith is in the costume that he wore at the Hilcomara. So they did a lot of research, which really is very touching, and for Mormons is very fun.
Well, and if you've ever heard the authors be interviewed, these are kids with absolutely no guile, you know, and they like Mormons, you know. They one of them grew up with Mormons, and as a matter of fact, in the Tony, I think in accepting the award, they said that this actually began by wanting to be in a Mormon family, which is what the South Park episode is all about. They're just so nice. Well, being nice is not necessarily a nice thing, but This is not an attack on the church. It's very friendly and warm. And they're much angrier with Jews, which one of them is.
Is that where they got their bad language?
Judaism wrote in the source.
Wrong, they had a hand up.
Wait, you can tell, just in the audience, there's, you know, you can tell the people, and the writers have said this, that they can hear the people that are Mormon in the audience just because of little references, you know. In the John Stewart interview, they mention the prophet Abinadi, and they say that people are laughing, and they know that they're LDS. So that, just to comment on the idea of research and, you know.
At the same
time,
excuse me for stepping. The kid who's Elder Price, a wonderful singer and performer, who is a lot like I was as a missionary. I mean, really sincere. And when he was in,
especially me.
When the song was introduced at the Tonys, they said Elder Price, who has found himself afraid and retreated, decides to double down on his religion and go for it. I mean, very congratulatorily. And the kid, when he was interviewed about taking role, to show you how very little they know about Mormons, he said, "At first I was hesitant because I didn't want to be murdered." I mean, there are people out there who think that we're Muslims, you know? I mean, the bad kind of Muslims. And you can watch General Conference, and some parts of it could lead you to believe, you know. So I think it's great for the church because it humanizes us, and I think the church is taking the right tack by saying nothing at all. At least I'm not familiar. They've said anything.
Just the one little statement.
Well, go ahead and say what you're going to say, Rhonda.
Okay. I'm my testimony, just commentary. I don't have any questions. I, after watching the John Stewart interview, got online and bought a ticket. And because it was I was buying a single ticket, I was going to be in Manhattan anyway, there was one available. It was an incredible experience. It was an incredible musical. And my daughter said, after a couple months, "You must have loved it because you can't stop talking about it." It was very impactful. But it had so much vulgarity, I hated it at the same time. And it was just, I couldn't even repeat a third of what happened. But the music, the production, and it reflected back to me, as Holly captured so much of, the characteristics of Mormonism, the over-the-top guilt, niceness, homogeneity, in so many ways that you kind of struggled with, and yet a good side too. And then there's also the message of religion can have a really positive impact, even if it's not literally true. And I just went, whoa. Yes. But anyway, it was an amazing experience, even though I don't recommend it to anyone.
It's one of the virtues of being the moderator. I didn't talk every so often. A couple things that I want to say. First of all, though there hasn't been another official church statement, there was a piece in the Deseret News published within almost minutes of the Tony Awards, maybe more like hours, but it was pretty darn quick, talking about how all the doctrinal inconsistencies. Mostly they quibbled with whether or not Jesus has his own planet, and we'll get our own planet as well. But there was this undercurrent of...
Wait a minute, isn't that true?
I don't know if we can talk about that.
Well, Richard Bushman says that's not... He's like...
Because that's the one thing that keeps me in the church.
Richard Bushman, he said it's a... He said, "We don't really know, and so we have to joke about these things." And I actually have written a piece that...
He said it's preposterous.
Yeah. And he says, "We joke about these things because we don't actually know." Well, part of the problem is we don't know because we can't talk about so many things. I'm doing a panel later today on the fact that BYU finally published BYU Studies published an essay saying, you know what, that whole thing about how you can't talk about Mother in Heaven, you can talk about her, it's just that we don't know anything to say about her because we have absolutely no revealed knowledge about her. So there are all these things we're not supposed to talk about. We're not supposed to talk about the temple. How can we get stuff right? How can we give people an accurate view of what we believe if there's so much we're prohibited from discussing? As for the profanity aspect of it, perhaps I'm a little desensitized to that in certain ways because I taught at Midwestern and Northeastern universities where my students would talk like that in class. But for many years, I have had an interest in war literature and more specifically combat memoir, because combat memoir has been the closest thing I could find to approximate what my mission was like. You volunteer to go undertake this enterprise that is going to make the world better and is going to make you a better person. And it's going to save people. And it will be redemptive and difficult, and there's sacrifice involved. But you're improving the world. And then you get there, and you realize to your horror that it's just not what you were told, and that actually there are lots of chicken shit rules and mean bastards who love enforcing them, and that it's this real battle. I mean, the militaristic hymns, Honored Christian Soldiers, are utterly, utterly apt. And even though I was distressed to watch this play and realize how peripheral women were to it, it was the first thing I'd ever seen that actually approximated, that was about me. It was the first thing I'd ever seen that was about me. And one of the songs, I forget which one, but I watched multiple interviews with Parker and Stone, and they talked, I think it was Hasidiga Iboai, they said was the Welcome to Vietnam song. And that's literally what they called it. And I thought, okay, they do get it. And that's part of what I was trying to get at in my presentation. They weren't interested with, while I respect them immensely for all the research and fact-checking they did, and if you compare that to, for instance, Angels in America, this is far more accurate. Angels in America plays fast and loose with Mormonism in ways the South Park guys would never dream of doing. They are mostly interested in capturing the emotional experience, and they nail it. I feel at this point I should offer the microphone to my panelists before I give it back to you. Anybody want to say something?
Just off of your comment earlier, if you watch the South Park episode all about Mormons, at the very end, the Mormon character gives a speech about how religion, even if it's false, can make you happier. So if you look on the Wikipedia page, all about Mormons, that speech is on the Wikipedia page, even if you can't find the episode. It'll kind of sum up the Book of Mormon musical and that idea. So I just wanted to throw that.
You can find the episode.
It's
easy to get along the South Park website.
On the South Park
website. I thought that was a very interesting comment from somebody. I guess you saw the play and decided you can't recommend it. you're pulling our leg.
With all kinds of caveats. I don't know what somebody else's response to it will be. So I'm very hesitant.
It probably is hard to describe in a literal sense to your next door neighbor and with all the language and all. But I don't know. I guess that's not something we're as sensitized as we used to be. I don't think we have to use that language as our shared advice, kind of forgiving her. But we don't have to be offended by it either. We can sort of see it as part of the forest and either choose to use language or not. It's a choice that it's personal. But I wasn't overwhelmed by the offense of the language. I thought the music and the frame of reference and the reality of these missionaries was so good. And if you imagine how strict the MTC is and how far they go from that. Do we have anybody who taught at the MTC in the group here? Yes, there's one. to. I'd sort of like to hear your comments, if you're willing to give them, as to the arc of their travels in becoming missionaries as they were to Uganda. But I also think that the metaphor to reach the Ugandans was very important. These people were had a reality which was a lot more physical and a lot more, if you care about me, let's get horizontal. Very, very down to earth and different from the civilization that we come from here. I thought they caught that very well, the humor, the irony, and I would say go to New York and see it, be the most fun, but we sure hope it comes here.
Well, to further enshrine my chauvinism, that is how I thought about most women, including on my mission. I think 19-year-old boys are going to be 19-year-old boys regardless. And I think it's also one of my daughters who really loves the play cautioned me, and she said, you know, you're such an idealist. And she said, this is not the way for a Mormon from Panguitch to discover theater. And if you take just the song about God and all of the ways to know God, just that song by itself, I think, is over the top and was written to be offensive. And it does offend. I brought this up to Mike Quinn last night over dinner, and I said, well, you know, how do you rationalize a song about that? And he said, well, you know, in its context, you know, that when you realize how it happened, you're right, this is really offensive. So there is that.
I absolutely have to disagree with you on the way you are responding to baptize me. It's a metaphor. There is no indication. In fact, we are told very specifically that if either of the missionaries lays a hand on Nabalumi, Nabalumi's father will rape them and give them AIDS. It's a metaphor, and that's what's important. And this is extremely the point is that the baptism is sexualized, and that priesthood. What's that word for the priesthood thingies? The rituals. There's a word.
Ordination.
Yes. That they are sexualized, and I actually know of women who would invent some malady so that they could ask the priesthood holder they were interested in to give them a blessing. And it's a metaphor for courtship. The point is not that Nabalungi invites one of the elders to have sex with her. The point is that within Mormonism, rituals like baptism and so forth are sexualized and are part of courtship. So, all right. This guy up back here had his hand up.
I saw the show, and I laughed as hard as I've ever laughed in my life. And at times I wept. And I thought it was the best thing I've ever seen. And I can't recommend it highly enough. I think that its lasting impact in Mormon culture, and there's a whole impact it will have the rest of the world's view of Mormons that's separate, but in Mormon culture, a lot of people are realizing that not all the truth claims that have been put forward by the church traditionally through the 70s and 80s, this correlated version of Mormon, the Mormon experience, is not necessarily all true. And it's deeply disturbing to many people. And the Book of Mormon musical takes that on directly, as has been mentioned, and says that if it works, then maybe it's okay if it's not all true. And I think it's a very powerful message that will be heard far more widely than we get that message out at Sunstone Symposium, right? And we talk about that here. But there's so few of us here. And those that are struggling with their Mormonism and are no longer believing in the truth claims of all of the story will see this musical, because they'll be more inclined, or less inclined, I should say, to be offended by the by the lyrics, maybe, if they're questioning other aspects of Mormonism. They'll go to this, and the impact it will have on them is to say, maybe it's okay. Maybe it's enough that the church is good, and it's a good place to raise kids, and it does good things. And they'll stay while abandoning some of their beliefs and the veracity of the story. So I loved it. And I thought it was a more accurate mirror of my experience growing up as a Mormon and a fully invested missionary teaching at the MTC and graduating from BYU. And I thought it was brilliant.
Could I just do the flip side of that quickly? Because I think the opposition of the church is the same as we found with the Salamander letter. The church didn't buy and bury the Salamander letter because it was false. They did it because they were afraid it was true. And I think that it's this whole thing about being prepared to be a fool for Christ. Let's assume everything in the musical is absolutely true. I was raised believing it's true, but most of it I still believe is true. Are we prepared to be that kind of a Mormon and have people ask us, you really think you're going to get your own planet? Well, not everybody. Me, sure, but mostly me, my father, Royal Leach, but to be able to accept ourselves ironically and at the same time say, hey, this is a part of the cross we got when we became Mormons. To be these kinds of people, to have these kinds of historical beliefs and not be ashamed of ourselves, not be ashamed of our own history.
It'll actually help people stay in the church.
Yeah, I think so.
And Cliff, you'd welcome a few of those women you baptized.
Right? Well, I've been itching to see this since before, like George Smith's class, it was even reviewed or anything.
Hold it close.
Okay, my sister wants to go in October because that's her New York trip, so we have tickets in October. So I'm very much looking forward to it. Listening to the lyrics, it got me especially thrilled. I had a couple of questions, and maybe it's not the place to address them, but what I thought was interesting, as far as I can tell, they do go for the easy joke of polygamy, and then also, or ridicule or whatever, but how Ugandans are portrayed in it, and how you feel about that, if that's even something you want to address here, because that's what a friend of mine found the most offensive in the play, in the musical.
I have a pirated DVD of the early previews, and there is a throwaway line about Brigham Young and polygamy, so apparently it didn't play well. The Ugandan stuff is appalling, and Peggy Fletcher Stacks has really interesting things to say about it. Her son went to Uganda on his mission. I actually tried to get him to be on this panel. They are caricatures. Do we want to
open up? African Americans are more angry about it than Mormons.
One of the sources that I quoted earlier was Glenn Reynolds. He was sitting by an African American woman. If you just Google his Glimpses, Mormon Artists blog or something, and he kind of gives a play by play about how this African American woman was reacting. Everyone's got a different seat in the theater, whether you're whoever you are, you're looking at things in different ways. And so that was interesting. I think also they when they get the mission call to Uganda, that would be a really cool call to get. I think if you were a 19-year-old, but they make this sound, so it's this kind of a punishment right away, which you would probably get if it's like I am, but they make Uganda into this other place right away. And there is this sort of, especially when they do the song at the end, there is this sort of minstrelsy going on, which American theater, musical theater comes out, parts of it come from that. And, none of the characters are that complex, but the least complex are those.
Is it the parody of Americans, how they see Africans? Is that how it came across? A statement or a parody of how Americans stereotype Africans?
I don't think it's what it is right now.
It's purely defamatory to Africans. I mean, it treats them as low-level thugs.
I think it's a curious moment when they say to the Ugandans, oh, and by the way, in 1978, we gave the priesthood to blacks. And then you have the Africans sort of, oh, that's very interesting. I would think that the African response would be, what a foolish parody you're going through here. Maybe our conversation is over. You know, I would expect a natural reaction to find that very kind of stupid and offensive. And how do you see the musical doing?
In the musical, the Africans don't say that's interesting. They're offended by it.
They literally, at that point, shove a Book of Mormon up the guy's ass.
But the critics who have supported it from the African American side have pointed out that maybe the African community has gotten beyond being offended by Amos and Andy caricatures when it comes to slapstick comedy. You know, maybe the community is not as militant as it once was. So I think there are people in the African community who are making the same arguments to them that we are making to ourselves. And but by far, they have the bigger gripe.
I guess I would say that would be embarrassing to the Mormons and to the missionaries to be telling Africans, oh, by the way, in 1978. It just looks so foolish. Before 78, and why, and it's just unexplainable.
But true.
And then, of course, there is the song I Am Africa, which, you know, nine white guys in white baptismal clothes singing, I am Africa, I am the winds of the Serengeti, you know, we are the lost boys of the Sudan, the tears of Nelson Mandela. And then some of my favorite lines in the whole musical, and I haven't quoted much, so indulge me. We are the sunrise on the savannah, a monkey with a banana, a tribal woman who doesn't wear a bra. Africans are African, but we are Africa. And so there is this absolute wholesale appropriation of the entire continent as a vehicle for Mormon expression, Mormon identity, white male Mormon identity exploration. Yeah.
But Mormon missionaries do that.
Absolutely. I love the people of wherever so much. Anyway, we are out of time. I am sorry we didn't get to hear from more of you. I love talking about this, so if you have more to say, talk to me, and thank you for coming.